From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Last night on NYPD Blue, Detective John Kelly quit the force. It was Kelly's final episode because actor David Caruso left the series to pursue a film career. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with NYPD Blue's co-creator David Milch about writing the plotline for Caruso's final exit. Also, detective novelist Lawrence Block reads from his new Matthew Scudder book. And why are American voters so angry with politicians? We talk about that and other election issues with Steve Roberts, senior writer with U.S. News and World Report and a panelist on Washington Week in Review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The man accused of shooting at the White House will be held without bail until his trial. The U.S. magistrate reviewing the Francisco Duran case rejected his lawyer's argument that he was only firing at a building and didn't hurt anyone. NPR's John Greenberg reports.
The hearing in Washington was held in a courtroom normally reserved for major drug trials. Reporters and other spectators watched the proceedings from behind a high wall of bulletproof glass. Duran listened impassively as the judge decided there was probable cause for him to stand trial on four felonies: possession of a firearm as a convicted felon, destruction of U.S. property, assault on a federal officer, and use of a firearm during a crime. Following a doctor's evaluation, defense and prosecution lawyers agreed Duran is mentally competent to stand trial. The prosecution made no mention Duran might be charged with attempted assassination. According to press reports, a note found in Duran's car suggests he planned to kill the president. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
Both sides have rested their case in the murder trial of anti-abortion activist Paul Hill. The prosecution questioned the widow of one of the victims who was shot to death allegedly by Hill. June Barrett identified Paul Hill as the man who shot her husband James and Dr. John Britton to death outside a city abortion clinic. Mrs. Barrett says Hill was holding a pamphlet in his hand when he pulled out a gun and began firing. Hill is representing himself at trial, but he questioned no witnesses before resting his case. He did ask to re-argue his justifiable homicide defense, but the judge refused. A new poll shows the Senate race in Massachusetts is turning in favor of incumbent Senator Edward Kennedy. NPR's Anthony Brooks reports.
Until recently, Senator Ted Kennedy was locked in a dead heat with Republican businessman Mitt Romney, who says it's time for a change, time to end the 32-year political career of one of the Senate's liberal stalwarts. Kennedy casts Romney as a ruthless venture capitalist who puts profits ahead of people. Last week, a pair of debates seemed to push Kennedy into the lead, and now a new Boston Herald poll shows Kennedy with a comfortable 15-point advantage with broad support from the Democratic Party faithful. Although another poll by the Boston Globe shows Romney gaining, it too gives the incumbent senator a 15-point lead. Romney is now running ads featuring pictures of blighted urban neighborhoods he calls Kennedy country. Kennedy blames 12 years of Republican rule for dismantling urban policy in America. This is Anthony Brooks in Boston.
The government's main gauge of future economic activity was unchanged in September. The Commerce Department says the index of leading economic indicators was the same in September as it was in August. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down almost 23 points at 38.40. This is NPR. Dozens of workers are slowly trying to identify the victims from the crash of the American Eagle commuter plane on Monday night. Some 75 people are working in the muddy Indiana soybean field. All 68 people aboard died in the crash. State police officials say about 30 FBI investigators have joined the work. The recovery effort has been slowed by heavy rain and mud, but the sun has come out today. Officials hope to begin removing some of the remains. There are reports of damage and arrests on the first day of San Francisco's newspaper strike. Representatives of the city's two major papers say five of their delivery trucks have been destroyed and as many as 30 cars have been damaged. NPR's Tui Vu reports.
The San Francisco newspaper agency, which represents the Chronicle and Examiner, says it doesn't know who's responsible for the damage to its vehicles. Police have also reported other incidents. This morning, the California Highway Patrol says picketers allegedly tried to force a newspaper delivery truck off the road by throwing what appeared to be nails. And two protesters have been arrested on charges of smashing the windows of vehicles at a printing plant. The Chronicle arrived at only a few locations this morning, and it's uncertain how the Examiner will be distributed. About 2,600 workers have walked off their jobs. Management and unions are divided over wages and job security issues. The unions are vowing to put out their own free alternative newspaper. I'm Thuy Vu in San Francisco.
There are conflicting reports from Egypt on how many people died in an oil depot explosion. There are reports that hundreds of people have been killed after the blast and fire. The Egyptian Interior Ministry says it seems heavy rain collapsed a bridge at the depot, which touched off the explosion. The statement also says that heavy flooding has killed more scores of people in other villages. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ever since actor David Caruso decided not to renew his contract with NYPD Blue, fans of the show wondered how he'd be written out of the series. Last night we found out. In previous episodes, his character Detective John Kelly had destroyed evidence and lied in court to protect his lover and fellow officer Janice LaCalce. After an internal investigation, last night Kelly was transferred and demoted to the position of radio dispatcher. Unwilling to accept this demeaning change, he quit.
They get my badge, but they don't get me to beg.
Don't let them do it.
What do you want me to do?
John, you can write it out.
Andy, they will find something.
It's IAB. They can't find their heads up their own ass.
They will find something. Look how hard they're trying to nail me. They will find something. And I am not answering phones until they do.
John.
You know I'm right. I thought I was gonna be 65 when I left this job. Kick it and scream for that age waiver. Thanks, buddy.
Back at you.
Tell Fancy I'll clean out the locker later, okay?
That's David Caruso as John Kelly, with Dennis Franz as Kelly's partner Andy Sipowicz. We wanted to know why the writers chose this storyline for Caruso's final exit, so we asked the series' co-creator, David Milch.
Our concern from the time we knew that David would be leaving was to have his departure consistent with the personality and values of his character, and it was our feeling that Kelly, who was very much his own man and followed his own set of values to the extent that those coincided with the rules and regulations of the department, fine, and when they didn't, he felt that he had to stay true to his own personal code. That such a character was at risk, and the storyline that we had been developing involving his relationship with LaCalce was at hand to do that. That is, he took the stand and lied for LaCalce and wound up paying the price for that. As to the particulars, his being transferred rather than fired, the firing of a cop is a protracted process involving hearings and so on. And our feeling was that Kelly wouldn't have, even if we'd wanted to do it, Kelly wouldn't have sat still for that. That he would have resigned. What he was assigned to do essentially was to man the telephone at Borough Dispatch. It's as demeaning a job as there can be, So he quit instead.
Now, I thought that Kelly was going to get killed either by a hitman in revenge or by a cop killer, because there was a cop killer episode that was just on. And I thought, well, this would be a dramatic way of getting rid of him. And also, it did occur to me that there might be some resentment against him on the part of the staff and they might want to write him out so completely for spite so that he could never come back, even if his film career fails.
Yeah, well, he can never come back, even if his film career fails. Trust me on that. But, that was not something that we felt would have been appropriate. Any cop is at risk any day that he shows up for work. We all know that. But we wanted Kelly's departure to have to do specifically with his nature and his personality. And so, I know you were half kidding in talking about the personal feelings that we as producers might have had about the series of events which led up to David's leaving. But it was very important to Stephen and me that we not let that affect the way we handled the character. To David Caruso's credit, he was rigorous about making sure that his performance, that whatever difficulties we were having, his performance remained effective and truthful, and we felt an equivalent obligation. To be honest, I'm proud of the way that I'm proud that we didn't do any of that stuff.
So tell me what some of the alternate ideas were for ending the character on the series. What were some of the ideas that were tossed around and debated?
There never were other ideas. You know, there was the occasional perverse suggestion, you know, about but those were all offhanded about disastrous ends that the character could meet. But seriously, nothing was ever contemplated other than what we did, because I must tell you that a small segment of critics have suggested that what happened to Kelly this year was inconsistent with the character that was portrayed last year, and that to me is nonsensical. It seemed to me that what happened to Kelly this year is exactly consistent with the character that we saw last year. He stood up for what he believed, and he was willing to pay the price for it.
Now, the last episode with David Caruso was I thought surprisingly low key.
Yeah.
Did you want that? Was that intentional?
Well, yeah. David was very much of the feeling that there was an inevitability to what was happening, and so the choices he made within the script that he was given were to play things in a very subdued manner, that he was reconciled to, or certainly had so anticipated what was happening that there was no element of surprise. But in general, what we had tried to do in the four episodes seen cumulatively was to generate such a momentum toward this end that really none of the characters was surprised by it. It was almost the case, I guess, from the time Kelly in the second episode tells the borough captain Haverhill to kiss his ass, there really weren't a whole lot of options for him.
What was supposed to happen to David Caruso's character before you realized that Caruso was leaving the show and you had to write the character out? How were you going to resolve the fact that he lied to protect Janice Lucchese?
He was going to get away with it. She was going to go away, which is just what happened to her.
To prison.
To prison. And he was going to get away with not having told the truth on the stand. The rumor is that occurs periodically in real life. And that was how we intended to handle that. Because Kelly had such a strong personal sense of right and wrong, we felt, was a personality which could withstand, perhaps in a way that Lucchese's couldn't, knowing that he hadn't told the truth in the, you know, in at the literal level, he hadn't told the truth, but he felt that he was being truthful to the spirit of her character and to what she had done and so on. So he was gonna go on as the answer.
You're bringing on a new character that will be played by Jimmy Smits, who used to be on L.A. Law.
Right.
Tell us something about what this character is going to be. Is it next week? Does he come on next week?
No, there are some elections. Everyone vote.
Or oh, don't. Yes, right.
And
I remember those.
And in the following week will be Jimmy's first episode. He plays a character named Bobby Simone, and he is whose previous assignment we will discover was working for the police commissioner, a kind of plum assignment, which also has some downside to it. The first show will get into that, Simone's relationship with Sipowicz is kind of at the center of the opening sequence of episodes. Sipowicz is a character who accommodates change only very grudgingly, and in general, and specifically because of his enormous loyalty toward Kelly, has a lot of resistance to the new pairing, and that works itself out for better or worse over the initial arc of those episodes.
What's the ethnic background of the Jimmy Smits character?
You're gonna have to tune in. It's a big point.
That's a thing, huh?
Yeah, that's a thing. or as Sipowicz says to him in one episode, "You're part something, aren't you?"
My guest is David Milch, co-creator of NYPD Blue. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Last Night was David Caruso's last episode on NYPD Blue. My guest is David Milch, co-creator of the series. Milch also was a writer and executive producer for Hill Street Blues. You had to write out characters in Hill Street Blues for various reasons.
And
I mean, one reason was the death of one of the actors. Did you learn anything in dealing with that in Hill Street that you were able to apply when David Caruso left?
Not really, because Hill Street was very much an ensemble, and so there wasn't the kind of fundamental jar to the foundation of the world. The closest thing, I guess, to that was when Michael Conrad, who played the turnout sergeant, passed away. But Michael had been so ill for so long, and we had accommodated that by diminishing his role over the course of a couple of years, so that when the end came, he really, Michael would very bravely would sort of leave the hospital, would be getting transfusions, and he'd leave the hospital and just do the roll call. And he really had nothing else to do in the show, so that the fabric and texture of the show really was not rent the way that, John Kelly had everything to do with everything in the present series. And so nothing like that happened in any other shows that I worked on. You know, Joe Coffey left, the character played by Eddie Marinaro. But there, too, Eddie was an important part of the show, but he wasn't the guy.
So what was it like when that final episode with David Caruso, which we saw last night, wrapped?
David did his last shot and he walked out the door.
And that was that?
That was that.
Sounds like the character on the show.
But
no long goodbyes?
About 20 minutes later, they were cleaning out his trailer. No long goodbyes.
Did you want more of a sense of completion, or...
That was about the sense of completion that I had anticipated. I mean, I happened to be down there, you know, and we shook hands and he split. But That was the consummation that had been anticipated by both parties, and David felt no need or reason to linger, and I have no argument with that.
There was an article last week in the New York Times about how crime shows on television compared to the real police in New York. And under the caption, under a photograph of David Caruso, reads, "David Caruso leaves the series after Tuesday's episode. His character lies in court to protect a fellow officer, leading to his decision to leave the force rather than be transferred." Well, that pretty well gives away what happened last night.
Yeah, that pretty well gives it away.
Well, how'd you feel about that?
Not in the thorough detail that the
guy
from the New York Daily News gave it away on Sunday. I'm told that he intercepted the satellite transmission of the show and printed chapter and verse about all the dialogue and everything else. And that seems to me to be, I mean, you know, there is such a passion for novelty and for the being in possession of facts that other people don't have. But in the absence of anything other than the sort of twitch of novelty, you know, I just think it's regrettable that they would that the guy would see fit. I mean, he's got to make a living, but I just didn't see the point of doing that. It just seems to me to take away from the viewer's legitimate right to experience the show on his or her own terms. But I mean, you know, a long time ago, James Fenimore Cooper wrote a novel where he predicted that the time would come when facts would become articles of commerce and traded as such. And, you know, that's another example of that prediction having come to pass.
Thanks a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure.
It's fun how we could talk about all your characters as if they're people we all know.
Yeah, that's, you know, there a lot of people talk about the downside of writing series television, but It does give you a wonderful if the audience likes your show, they take those characters to their heart the way they do almost characters in no other medium, because they're there with them every week, and they become fiercely loyal to and invested in those characters.
Well, thanks again.
Okay, so long.
David Milch is co-creator of NYPD Blue. More about detectives for you. This year, Lawrence Block was named the 1994 Grand Master of the Mystery Writers of America. Block is a great reader, so we invited him to read an excerpt of his new novel, A Long Line of Dead Men. It's the 12th in his series featuring Detective Matt Scudder. Scudder is an unlicensed private detective, a former cop, and a recovering alcoholic. In the new novel, Scudder is hired by a member of a secret club to investigate why the members of the club are mysteriously dying. The club's only purpose is to meet once a year to record the passage of time. In this excerpt, we meet Scudder's old drinking buddy, Mick Ballou.
He is a large man, my friend Mick, tall and heavy, with a head that would not look out of place among the ancient sculptures on Easter Island. There is a primitive and monolithic quality to him. Years ago, a wit at Morrissey's After Hours described Stonehenge as looking like Mick and his brothers standing in a circle. It may be fitting, then, that he is just about the last of a vanishing breed, the tough Irish criminals who have been drinking and fighting and raising hell in the West 40s and 50s since before the Civil War. Various gangs and mobs held sway, the Gophers, the Rhodes Gang, the Parlor Mob, the Guerrillas. A lot of their leaders were saloon keepers, too, from Mallet Murphy and Paddy the Priest to Oney Madden. They were as cheerfully vicious as any group New York ever saw, and they might have made a more lasting mark on the place if they hadn't had such an all-consuming thirst. According to Mick, God created whiskey to keep the Irish from taking over the world. It had certainly kept the Hell's Kitchen hoodlums from taking over the city. A few years ago, some newspaper reporters started calling the current crop the Westies, and by the time the tag caught on, there was hardly anybody left to pin it to. The neighborhood bad guys were mostly gone, dead of drink or violence, doing life sentences somewhere upstate, rotting away in the back wards at Manhattan State Hospital. or they were married and living somewhere in the Jersey suburbs, getting fat and sluggish, running crooked auto repair shops, rigging the Games and Church Las Vegas night fundraisers, or working all week for their fathers-in-law and drinking themselves sodden on the weekends. Mick, the son of a woman from County Mayo and a father born in France, not far from Marseille, was a man who drank whiskey like water, a career criminal, a brutal killer who would costume himself for a night of slaughter in the butcher's apron his father had worn, then wear the same apron to Mass at St. Bernard's. There was no reason why we should have become friends and no way to explain our friendship. Nor could I find an explanation for these long nights of ours, when the stories flowed like water or like whiskey. He would drink for both of us, filling his glass time and time again with the 12-year-old Jameson. I would keep him company with coffee, with Coca-Cola, with soda water. Maybe, as Jim Faber has suggested, it was a way for me to have the drink without the hangover, to recapture the sweetness of saloon society without risking a seizure or liver damage. Maybe, as Elaine proposed, the two of us had a long karmic history together and were just renewing the ties that had bonded us in innumerable past lives. Or perhaps, as it sometimes occurred to me, Mick was at once the brother I never had and the road I'd left untaken. And maybe we're both just men who like a long night in a quiet room and a good story or two. A long line of dead men, he said. How's that? Ah, it's a story. Do you know Barney O'Day? He used to come to Morrissey's. I never met him there, I said, but I knew him when I was at the 6th. He managed a bar on West 13th Street. They had live music, and sometimes he'd get up and sing a song. Had he any sort of a voice? I don't think he was any worse than the paid entertainment. I used to run into him at the Lion's Head, too. What about him? Well, it's a story I heard another man tell at a wake, he said. It seems Barney's old mother was in the hospital, and he was at her bedside, and the dear told him that she was ready to die. I had a good life, says she, and wrung all the joy I could out of it, and I'm not after having machines keeping me alive and tubes sticking out of me. So give us a kiss, Barney, my lad, says she, as you were always as fine a son as a mother could ask for, and then tell the doctor to pull the plug and let me go. So your man gives her a kiss and goes off to find the doctor and tells him straight out what the old woman wants him to do. And the doctor's scarcely more than a boy himself. He hasn't been at it long, and Barney can see he's got no stomach for this sort of thing. He wants to be prolonging life, not cutting it short. He's troubled, and Barney's a gentle soul himself, for all the bluster he puts on, and wants to spare the man some agony. Doctor, says he, put your mind at ease. It's not such a terrible thing you have to be doing. Doctor, let me tell you something. We O'Days come from a long line of dead people. Outside, the wind blew up and drove rain against the windows. I looked out and saw cars passing, their lights reflected in the wet pavement. That's a wonderful story, I said. Ever since it was told to me, he said, I've carried the line around with me. For don't we all come from a long line of dead people? Your tale of the club put me in mind of it. 31 men, and one by one they go to their graves, and the last man left starts it all over again. A long line of dead men stretching back through the centuries. All the way to Babylon, rumor has it. All the way to Adam, he said. All the way to the first fish that grew hands and hauled himself ashore.
Lawrence Block, reading from his new novel, A Long Line of Dead Men. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, why are American voters so angry? And how might that affect the outcome of Tuesday's elections? We talk with Steve Roberts, senior writer for U.S. News & World Report, and a former congressional correspondent for The New York Times. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A jury has cleared journalist Janet Malcolm of libel charges. The suit was brought by a psychoanalyst who accused her of fabricating quotes in a New Yorker magazine article. Jim Bryant reports from San Francisco.
Veteran journalists had been accused of inventing or changing five quotes in an article about scholar-turned-analyst Jeffrey Mason for the magazine in 1983. The jury found that Malcolm had materially changed two of the five quotes, but did so without either knowing that they were false or with reckless disregard for the truth, a necessary element in libel of a public figure. There is no decision as yet as to whether an appeal will be filed in this retrial in this decade-old case, which has already gone to the Supreme Court in pretrial disputes. When the verdict came in, an emotional Malcolm hugged first her husband, then her attorney, and said, "It's over." For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Bryant in San Francisco.
A tip about two missing South Carolina boys has turned out to be a false alarm. Union County Sheriff Howard Well says a phone tip from law enforcement officials in another state involved another child. The parents of the two missing boys, aged 3 and 1, have made another public appeal for their safe return. Mother Susan Smith says the boys were kidnapped when someone seized her car last week. Three Iranians linked to the government in Tehran went on trial today in Paris for the assassination of the last Iranian prime minister under the Shah. The former prime minister was killed at his home near Paris in 1991. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Prosecutors say the murder of Shapur Bakhtiar was carried out by Iranian agents and orchestrated in Tehran. One defendant is a nephew of the late Ayatollah Khamenei, and another is related to Iranian President Rafsanjani. Besides the three men in court, six other Iranians are being tried in absentia, and one is a government advisor in Tehran. The Iranian government denies responsibility for the killing. However, security sources say Tehran pressured France to drop the trial and even threatened to carry out terrorist attacks. French police have stepped up security at train stations, department stores, and in tourist areas. The defendants are being tried by a special terrorist court composed only of judges. The hearings will last 1 month. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Officials at NASA say bad weather overseas could threaten tomorrow's planned launch of the space shuttle Atlantis. Thick clouds and high winds are expected at all three emergency landing sites in Spain and Morocco. At least one emergency site must have good weather for a shuttle launch. That's in case it must land because of engine failure minutes after liftoff. Ironically, good weather is expected in Florida. Five Americans and a Frenchman are assigned to the 11-day environmental mission. They'll study the Earth's ozone layer. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower. The Dow lost more than 26 points to end the day at 3,837. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. President Clinton says he doesn't want to overreact to a shooting incident at the White House. He told the Detroit News today he'll take appropriate security steps, but says he won't hide. The suspect in the shooting incident has not been charged with trying to assassinate Mr. Clinton, but an official says prosecutors are thinking about filing an attempted assassination charge. Officials reportedly found a map in Francisco Duran's truck that said, "Kill the Prez." One of Duran's former co-workers says he heard Duran make threats against the president. The Department of Labor is seeking more than $1 million in fines and back pay from a Georgia onion farmer and a contractor who provided the farm with migrant workers. NPR's Melinda Pencava has more.
The Labor Department says 276 workers at Delbert Bland's farm were not paid according to minimum wage laws, and that other federal laws regarding living conditions were also violated. What makes this case different from most migrant farm worker cases before it is that the government has named Bland as a co-defendant. Bland says he did not know any laws were being broken. The Vidalia onion farmer had not hired the migrant workers directly, but instead had an independent contractor, James Rucker, take care of that. In the past, that arrangement appeared to help farmers avoid liability, but signaling a change, one labor official says both employers will be held responsible. And Secretary Robert Reich says growers have to be more mindful of what the farm labor contractors are up to. I'm Melinda Penkava in Washington.
Three American tourists still missing after a helicopter crash off the Mexican coast are presumed dead. The bodies of 10 other tourists and the Mexican pilot have been recovered. All but one of the tourists were Americans who were taking a day tour of ancient Indian ruins. A U.S. consular volunteer worker says the helicopter reported mechanical failure just before it crashed. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A week from today, we'll know what the new Congress will look like. Right now, there are many races for House and Senate seats that are too close to call, more close races than there have been in decades. Republicans hope to win the 40 more seats they would need to control the House and the 7 more to control the Senate. My guest, Steve Roberts, is following the elections for U.S. News and World Report, where he's a senior writer. He's also a panelist on Washington Week in Review. One theme that has emerged from this midterm election is that American voters are angry. In the current edition of U.S. News and World Report, Roberts investigates why. He's come up with 3 main reasons. Americans are squeezed financially. They're spending so much time eking out a living, there's not enough time to take care of their families. And they're worried about crime. I asked Roberts how this anger may be reflected in how America votes.
Really, when you sit around the kitchen tables of America these days and you say, what are you angry about? The first thing is not Washington or politicians. But they think that politicians are not understanding their problems and not listening to their problems and not helping them deal with their problems. In fact, they often think that politicians and government in general are making matters worse rather than better. Now, I'll give you a very graphic example. I talked to a woman in Youngstown who told me that this is a single mother of 4. And her kids came home from school with a little card given to them by the school system, which said that if your parents try to discipline you, you can call the child abuse hotline and report your own parents. Now, is child abuse a real problem? Yes, it is. Are there a couple of children in the Youngstown school systems who really might be saved from abuse by having some telephone number to call? Yes. But for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of parents in Youngstown, this is meddling in their family life, and this is the schools making their attempts to discipline their kids harder, not easier. And that symbolizes what they feel about government, and that's why you have a sense of anti-incumbency, anti-politician, anti-Washington, because people feel that Washington is simply out of touch with the lives that they're living.
Who do you think is going to stand a better chance of winning because of this popular anger, and who stands a better chance of losing because of it?
Well, 2 things are true. One is that in the last few weeks, a number of incumbents are doing somewhat better than they were a month ago. This is a natural pattern in many elections, many election seasons, because we focused for a long time, Terry, on the disadvantages of incumbency and a lot of what I've just been talking about, the voter anger focused on these institutions. When they come down to judging their individual member of Congress against his or her opponent, the dynamic changes. It becomes a real choice between 2 real people and not some abstract expression of dissatisfaction. And many incumbents have long records of service to their district and their state, and that's kicking in. It's also incumbents always have a lot more money than their challengers. I think that one of the biggest untold stories of 1994, Terry, is in fact there are a number of Republican governors of big states who are cruising to re-election with virtually no opposition. And we never hear about them because they're doing so well and there's no controversy and no contest. But if you look at William Weld in Massachusetts and John Engler in Michigan and Edgar in Illinois and Thompson in Wisconsin and George Voinovich in Ohio, this is one of the most important stories of 94. And the reason why these governors are doing so well is because they hit the middle ground. In some ways, they are closer to being new Democrats than Bill Clinton has been as president. They are hitting a middle ground between the extremes on both sides, the liberal Democrats who have a big government program for everything, and the extreme conservatives who say, you know, close down the government and go home. The American people do not want either extreme. What they want is sensible, sensitive, efficient, common sense government that does understand their problems and deals with them in an efficient way and doesn't cost them an arm and a leg in taxes. And these Republican governors, I think, come closest to the balance point that Americans are looking for. And I can tell you, I've talked to a lot of Republicans who say that the party should be looking to these governors as laboratories and as role models for where the Republican Party should be going in the next 2 years and the kind of candidate they should nominate in 96 and the kind of platform they should be running on.
I wonder if you see that trend as relating to another very small trend in this election, and that is that some moderate Republicans have disavowed more conservative ones. In New York, the mayor of New York City, Rudolph Giuliani, has endorsed the Democrat. He's endorsed Mario Cuomo and disavowed Pataki, who's running against Cuomo for governor. In Pennsylvania, the widow of Senator Hines has disavowed Rick Santorum, the Republican challenger to Harris Wofford in the Senate, and she's called Santorum a Forrest Gump with attitude.
This is very much part of the same phenomenon. You can add Mayor Reardon of Los Angeles, who has endorsed Dianne Feinstein, the Democrat, for re-election in California, a former Governor Elmer Anderson, who is a Republican who has endorsed the Democrat in the Senate race in Minnesota. And what these moderate Republicans are saying is that if the Republican Party is pulled too far to the right, and if their attitude is simply to obstruct, simply to oppose, simply to throw grenades, that the future of the Republican Party is not very bright. And they look at someone like Giuliani, Rudy Giuliani, and Giuliani says, look, I got to run a city here. I can't afford to just go up on Capitol Hill and make speeches. I've got to look to the best interests of my city and the best interests of my party, and that's going to be served by a Democrat who cares about the city and not by someone like Pataki, who is a very conservative right-winger who is also the creature of Senator D'Amato, who is one of the chief bomb throwers among the Republicans on Capitol Hill. It's very much a part of the same phenomenon. And, you know, the Republican Party is going to do very, very well in these elections. But one of the reasons is they're rather unified around the notion of opposing Bill Clinton. Very close to the surface, there are some very important splits in the Republican Party between this sort of moderate, pragmatic approach to government, problem-solving approach to government, set against some of the leaders on Capitol Hill, Newt Gingrich being the major example, whose whole role in life is simply to tear things down and be critical and are not builders but destroyers. And that basic fault line is going to reemerge after this election.
My guest is Steve Roberts, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the elections with Steve Roberts, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. Well, Newt Gingrich might become the Speaker of the House. He came up with something called the Contract with America, which has been signed by more than 300 candidates, Republican candidates, for the House. What is the agenda of that, and what direction do you see that leading the Republican Party in?
Well, the Contract for America was very carefully designed and very shrewdly drawn based on some very extensive polling that the Republicans did. In fact, you notice the Contract for America doesn't include the word Republican anywhere in it. That's because Republican didn't poll very well, and so they didn't include it. This is very much a made-for-TV political gimmick, but the fact is that the Democrats think, and I think the Democrats are in some ways overestimating the mistake. They seem gleeful over this, and they're running very hard against the contract because they think people remember the 80s with disdain. I think people remember the 80s fairly well. They liked Ronald Reagan. And even though Ronald Reagan's economic policies did certainly add to a much bigger deficit, I don't think the Democrats are necessarily going to prosper by saying the Republicans want to take us back to the 1980s. I think that that was a time when people were pretty positive about government, about their leadership. But there's no doubt that the contract continues an important element of Reaganism, and that is to simply choke off the sources of revenue for the federal government. When you talk about the balanced budget amendment, when you talk about the line item veto, when you talk about a number of other elements in this package, it's all designed to throttle the government, to shrink the government. And they've been rather successful in doing that. We're still dealing with the after effects, for instance, of the Reagan tax cut, which severely restricted the income flow to the federal government and is part of the reason why we have such big deficits. But it's also part of the reason why there has been much more discipline over federal spending.
You were talking before about the split between a very conservative and more moderate Republicans within the party.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that incoming Republicans are more likely to be conservative than outgoing Republicans?
Yes in the House, no in the Senate. It's interesting. The House, they've recruited a lot of very conservative people. House districts are a lot smaller. You can appeal to much more narrow constituencies. A lot of the energy in the Republican Party in recent years has come from the more conservative wing of the party. The religious right has been very active in Republican Party politics, has provided a lot of energy, a lot of workers, a lot of money to the party. But when you run statewide, particularly in larger states, you can't be so narrow. You have to be somewhat broader in your appeal, somewhat more open to other ideas, because by definition, you're heading up a coalition. And I think that in the House, the Republican Party is likely to be very, very conservative. Its leadership is very hard right and very confrontational in its style. But I think in the Senate, it'll be different. I think that you will have a stronger representation from the more moderate wing of the Republican Party. You have a number of Republicans who are openly willing to discuss cooperation with the Democrats, senators like Specter of Pennsylvania, Kassebaum of Kansas. The new senator from Maine is likely to be Olympia Snowe, who was a very progressive Republican when she was in the House. The other senator from Maine, Bill Cohn, is in the same mold. So you can count 6, 8, 10 Republicans who are there mainly for the purpose of passing legislation and dealing with problems and not just making speeches. And so I think the prospects for bipartisan cooperation in the Senate are reasonably good, in the House, pretty dismal.
If the Republicans win a majority in the House, then Newt Gingrich would become the House Speaker. He drafted the Contract with America. Early on, when he got voted into Congress, he founded the Conservative Opportunity Society. What direction do you see him leading the Republican Party in?
Well, Newt Gingrich is an extremely shrewd and extremely tenacious political operative. Democrats have underestimated him very often. One of the things that Newt Gingrich has been an absolute master at is understanding the nature of television and understanding that television is incapable of covering legislation in any real depth, and that they what television focuses on when they cover Congress are personalities and scandals and controversies, but not on legislation in any great depth. And he's been very successful at helping to create the negative mood in the country about Congress. Fact is, he has been probably Congress's most efficient opponent. And so if he were then to become Speaker of the House, it would be a very interesting and odd change where he actually would be responsible for moving legislation. And one of the open questions is whether he is capable of moving from being a bomb thrower on the outside. You know, it's much easier to throw grenades than it is to catch them. And it's an open question as to how he would evolve. He is very political. He views everything through the lens of how to enhance Republican prospects. And some of the frustration has been justified. The Republicans have been out of power for 40 years in the House. The Democrats have treated them with insistent disdain. They use the rules to repress the Republican ability to offer amendments. They cut back on their staffs. The Democrats might hate Newt Gingrich, but they've had a large role in helping to create him, because they've helped create the discontent and the frustration in Republican ranks that have led Republicans to choose a leader of this stripe. And it's a very interesting question as to whether he can now turn into a legislator with a real program, or whether he will just continue to play politics with everything. I think it's that question is yet to be answered.
My guest is Steve Roberts, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, with the election less than a week away, what do you have on the election?
We're bringing in some of the people who are going to be with us on election night and asking, what to this point in the campaign do we think this campaign has been about? So we'll be talking a little politics on All Things Considered, Terry. Also, we will revisit Northern Ireland 2 months into the ceasefire. Nina Totenberg is covering a case at the Supreme Court on age discrimination. We have a story on the contraceptive implant, Norplant, and the success that they are having using it to prevent teenage pregnancies. And we're going to follow up some details on the airline crash in Indiana.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We're talking about the elections with Steve Roberts, senior writer with U.S. News and World Report. I remember toward the end of George Bush's presidency, we had a talk about gridlock in Congress. And I wonder how you think the gridlock that President Clinton has faced compares to the gridlock that President Bush faced.
Well, I think Bill Clinton has made some very basic mistakes in dealing with the Congress. I think that he failed to read the polls and the election results very well. He acted as if he had gotten 53 or even 63% of the vote instead of 43% of the vote. I think that he tried too often to push bills through with just Democratic votes. George Bush, of course, never had that luxury. During his 4 years in Congress, the Democrats controlled the Congress, and his gridlock was a more familiar one, where he had to use his veto over 30 times simply to stop a Democratic legislative initiative. With a Democratic president and a Democratic control of the Congress, it was more a question of Clinton putting up bills and being too liberal for the mainstream of his party. And I think that he made two huge mistakes. One was not reaching across the aisle often enough and early enough to woo progressive Republicans to his side. Probably his single most significant legislative victory of 2 years, which was the passage of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, was done with heavy Republican support. I think that was part of a mindset. He ran as a new Democrat. He talked about being bipartisan. He talked about bringing Republicans into the White House, but he never really acted that way. I think that he helped bring a lot of the gridlock on himself by misreading where the balance point in American politics was. For him to come in with the kind of health care program, which just groaned and moaned under bureaucratic notions and proposals, and also that would have cost a great deal of money in taxes that Americans were not willing to pay.
You know, we started our conversation with You're talking about the anger so many American voters are feeling now and how that might affect the election next week. And I wonder if you think that that anger is giving away to cynicism. And if you think that that has a chance of lifting in the near future, or if you think that anger and cynicism is something we're going to be stuck with for a really long time when it comes to American politics.
That's a very good question. The anger, in many ways, is justified. The cynicism, in many ways, is manufactured and exploited and used by people who, for their own political views. A friend of mine, Tom Mann, here in Washington, who's a political scientist, describes the cynicism industry. And I think it's a good description. The anger is real. People are falling behind economically. 70% or 60% of the American public says in our polls at U.S. News that the American dream is impossible to achieve. The same number think that the economy is not in recovery, even though every economic indicator says that it is. So the concerns are real. People feel that they're falling behind. They're not living as well as their parents. They don't have time for their families. Their kids are being subjected to all these cultural influences that they don't agree with. There's a sense of stress and guilt and lack of control that is tangible. It just pops out at you every time you sit around a kitchen table or a cafe table in communities across this country. But that very real anger has been exploited by a whole network of people, some of them politicians themselves. There are so many politicians in both parties who are running against the very institution that they want to serve in. They're trashing Congress as they run against it. That helps create a cynicism about our leadership. Talk radio, that is part of the picture where everything is angry, everything is critical, everything is, every time you talk about a member of Congress, you talk about him as a corrupt scoundrel. That's an inaccurate and unfair picture, but that's the way it's done. And I must say my own profession of journalism is part of this conspiracy. We are part of this cynicism industry. We see Congress in an almost totally negative light, in part because Congress sees itself in a negative light. And all of that combined has created a very deep cynicism. People really don't trust their leaders anymore. And I worry about that because I think it's essential to a healthy democracy to have some measure of trust and confidence. And in the 60s, if you asked Americans in a poll, do you trust government to do the right thing most of the time? About 70% would say yes. Today, you ask people that question, only about 20% say yes. And that's an enormous and unhealthy change. We should hold leaders to a high standard. We as journalists have to be very tough on them. But we are edging over from justifiable skepticism to a kind of a savage cynicism. And we're all part of it. And we all have to take some of the blame. And I think it's going to be hard to reverse. And the only way you can reverse it is by Congress listening better, by the leadership listening better, by doing the things people really care about and trying to make a difference in their real lives. And then you can start to reverse that. But that's very difficult.
Steve Roberts, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Sure.
Steve Roberts is senior writer with U.S. News and World Report and a panelist on Washington Week in Review. I'm Cherry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The National Book Awards will be given later this month. On the next Fresh Air, we meet two of the nominees. Tobias Wolff discusses his new Vietnam memoir, In Pharaoh's Army, a follow-up to his memoir, This Boy's Life. And we talk with Howard Norman about his novel, The Bird Artist. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.